And this is really problematic.
Angela, President Piñera recently sparked outrage for posing in the main plaza in Santiago, where for months was the center of the raging anti-inequality protests that were taking place. The plaza has remained empty since the coronavirus has forced the country to shut down. Your response, the symbolism of what he was doing, and your final comment.
Well, when that action of taking that picture with this heroic posture, it was really outrageous, first of all, and also violent, because, as you said, this square called, it used to be called Plaza Italia, but during the uprising, we renamed this space as Plaza Dignidad, which is a dignity square, and it's been a very symbolic point. People have died there fighting, like, because of police brutality. And people have lost their sight because of being shot at directly at their eyes with rubber bullets. So when you see him, when he takes advantage of people being in quarantine and not allowed to go out, and he goes there.
We have like 5 seconds.
Okay, it's just showing his lack of empathy to this whole social process that we are living.
Angela Valenzuela, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Climate activist, 350.org organizer, former coordinator with Fridays for Future Chile. As we wrap up our 50th anniversary of Earth Day special in the midst of this raging pandemic, Democracy Now! Is working with as few people as possible, the majority of our team working from home. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Be safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metropolitan area. K282BH Philomath and 104.3 FM. And K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. This is your community connection, KBOO Portland. And you are listening to your morning talk radio strip. We have our host today, Paul Rowland, on, and we will commence immediately here with your morning strip inside Washington. Good morning, Paul. Are you with us?
Good morning, Celeste.
Good, good, good. Well, I did not have introductory music, so I didn't know if you wanted to take a second to perhaps have a 30-second moment of silence with Miles Davis, or just to commence.
Oh, heck, I'm ready. Let's just go right into it.
All righty.
Although I did see a Miles Davis documentary recently, which was really, really wild. Didn't know the full story of his life and what a truly amazing, amazing human being he was.
Another word for it is genius. And if you need an adjective, unmitigated.
Indeed.
All right. Well, I am turning the airwaves over to you, and I will let people know so they can preload their speed dial. The phone number for the call-in segment is 503-231-8187. And take it away, Paul.
Thanks, Celeste. I think that documentary, which is on Netflix currently, is I believe it's Birth of the Cool, if I'm not mistaken. Boy, just now you got me thinking, maybe we should have played that clip from Miles Davis to get us in the mood. But I don't know, just him going to Paris as a young man and falling in love with a young Parisian woman and feeling. And not just that; it was more the feeling of liberty he felt, being free from the daily grind of racism, and the limitations placed upon people of color in this country, and the feeling of freedom that he got, and the feeling of being appreciated as a peer and as a human being by. He got to meet with some of the cream of the intellectual Parisian society, Jean-Paul Sartre and others, and his and the jazz music was really appreciated by you sort of widely there. Anyway, and then coming back, I think, set him on both a darker path, but also his rise to greatness in the jazz world, or the continued rise to greatness. Anyway, I was just thinking of that. It's worth watching Birth of the Cool. Another thing looks like it's worth watching is a Michael Moore produced film by his longtime, I think, cinematographer Jeff Gibbs, called Planet of the Humans, which was just put out free of charge on YouTube yesterday. I didn't get a chance to see it yet. I'm going to read a little bit from an article. But before we go to all that, I wanted to talk, give my analysis, for what it's worth, of, well, let me just read this thing from Juan Gonzalez. I want to talk about the terrible deficiency of the Trump administration's response to this COVID pandemic. But specifically, I want to talk about these Liberate protests that are happening. I know Abe and Joe talked some about that yesterday, but it really struck me. I'm sure a lot of you heard Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now! Saying something I didn't quite expect it to come from him, and he sounded truly frightened. There was a tone in his voice that I had not heard. Let me just read this. But Amy, I wanted to talk about something else, which I think is very important. We're seeing a lot of it now, which is these protests around the country of people demanding an end to the shutdowns that were aimed to stop the spread of the pandemic. And what troubles me most about this is how right-wing extremists are brandishing automatic weapons, and they've become regular features of these protests. And with the man in the White House saying nothing to condemn this form of intimidation, and obviously most of them are Trump supporters. And I'd like our viewers and listeners to ask themselves a question. If hundreds of African Americans or Latinos showed up in cities around the country brandishing automatic weapons, I might say like the Black Panthers did in a much, much more limited degree, and we saw the backlash there. Anyway, continuing with Juan Gonzalez, what would be the response of the country to this? Why is this being almost accepted and normalized now as a method of protest? And my fear is that this will become normalized over the next few months as we head toward a bitter national election. And we should make no mistake that this country is edging closer and closer to neo-fascist authoritarianism. And then Amy Goodman asks of it being almost accepted. It's not almost. The president from the bully pulpit of the White House is encouraging it, right? Saying that these are his people. Well, he's encouraging the protests. And he's saying liberate these states with these protests. Right. This is Juan again. He's encouraging the protests. He hasn't directly, to my knowledge, encouraged the armed, the brandishing of weapons, but he's accepting it and praising these folks as wonderful Americans. And I don't think we should discount the possibility that this president will declare an election that he loses as a fraud and illegitimate, an attempt to stay in power. You know, some people may say this is far-fetched. I hope it is. But I think that we shouldn't delude ourselves that we're living in extraordinary times in the United States right now. Okay, well, that's that. That was Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now! Just yesterday on KBOO, amongst many other places. Okay, so what really galls me, and I've actually interacted with a few people on, strangely, this Climate Change Battle Royale. It's a Facebook site group where there's one of the few places that I see where people on the right, left, center kind of duke it out over specifically climate change, but it encompasses many other issues, including this COVID-19. So you see a lot of the sort of the cultural wars in the United States playing out there. Anyway, I've tried to actually have conversation about the fact that the only reason, in my mind, that we got to the point of these total shutdowns is because the response was inadequate. If you look at the countries where they're confronting this COVID-19 pandemic in a way that seems to be working more efficiently, there is isolation, there's large-scale testing, isolation of known infected people, and then what they call contact tracing of those that the people came into contact with, and checking out their health, testing them, and then quarantining them for, I guess, 14 days, and then if they turn up sick, then isolating them. That way, you can limit the, you know, I think a lot of those countries did end up in shutdown because this thing, you know, hit so hard so fast, but it allows people to come out of the shutdown a lot sooner and mitigate some of these terrible, terrible economic effects that we're having. That, right, you know, a lot of those people go to those protests are, you know, are upset and, you know, rightfully so in their minds, because they're, you know, they're legitimately struggling like so many people are. I don't know, you know, they're struggling more or less than other people. You know, I don't know how many minimum wage workers there are, you know, but, you know, without getting into the weed of the details, that seems to be the scenario. Okay, so what do we need? We need, you know, what these mutual aid groups are springing up all over the place, mostly on a very neighborhood, citywide level. But there is some, you know, state-to-state, like Oregon sent respirators to New York. They shouldn't have to. That's another thing I'm going to get into, an article, a really frightening article by David Wallace Wells in the New York Magazine, about how Trump is actually erecting a blockade, actually seizing and preventing shipments of PPE, personal protective equipment, to states and hospitals. Hopefully we'll have time to get into that. But, okay, so we need, you know, the pie in the sky. We need neighborhood, municipal, state, regional, interstate, national, and global cooperation. Obviously, the neoliberal economic order and the fierce nationalisms and the continuing competitions that go on is, you know, inhibiting that. Our very culture inhibits that. Yet, we need to put out some kind of vision. It seems like Biden and the Democratic Party are sort of missing in action. Unfortunately, I happen to think Sanders would have actually probably been offering more if he had the platform of the nomination. But, you know, we can't cry over that spilt milk right now. So one thing very specific I want to mention is that Massachusetts, in terms of contact tracing, Massachusetts is the first state to invest in an ambitious contact tracing program, budgeting $44 million to hire 1,000 people. Governor Charlie Baker is betting that the state will be able to identify pockets of infection as they emerge and prevent infected people from further spreading the virus. So we're talking about, again, the most effective and realistic approach to actually coming out of this in a way that leaves our people's livelihoods and health intact. And it's a job creation program, which gets to the theme, this is Earth Day. This is even the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. I probably, in more normal circumstances, I probably would have had a major focus on that. But this is what's happening on planet Earth, folks, right now. So, you know, it coincides with, you know, ideas of sort of Green New Deal, a transition, which, again, and at this time with the oil industry tanking, what a better time to transition away, as McKibben was talking about earlier. So we need bold strategies for dealing with this particular the pandemic crisis right now. We need strategies for creating new jobs, you know, maybe even better jobs. Why not, you know, like the Roosevelt administration totally regeared the economy towards a war-based economy. That was the utmost priority. Our president styles himself as a wartime president against the coronavirus. Of course, we know that he's not up to the task of even thinking through what that might mean. So we have to put out our vision. So we need to regear the economy right now towards dealing with the crisis. That's one excellent way, is pay people, you know, people who can't, I don't know, I saw saw something on the news last night, the local news, about these United employees who aren't able to fly offering their services to distribute food to people in, I think it was in New York. So, well, they could actually be being paid for that and many other things. Anyway, I think you all see where I'm going. So anyway, as Celeste said, the number is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I know things are, we've been having a little difficulty with the phones. I know last week on my show, my two guests, we tried to do some experiment with their computer. Didn't work out so well. A little bit of confusion. Today I'm flying solo. We're going to streamline it, looking for people, looking for some serious in-depth conversation about the best ideas to work together to move forward in this very, 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 very difficult and challenging time that we find ourselves in. So until I hear that there's a caller from Celeste, I want to read a little bit from this here it is. The White House has erected a blockade stopping states and hospitals from getting coronavirus PPE. This is on in New York Magazine, April 19, just a couple days ago. I don't know if you all have checked this out, but it's based upon a New England Journal of Medicine article. And I just want to read this. It's three long paragraphs, but this is okay, so he introduced it by saying, yesterday, a letter published by the New England Journal of Medicine highlighted the extraordinary measures that had to be taken to secure the delivery into Massachusetts of equipment that had been bought and paid for. The New England Journal of Medicine, which featured the letter in its COVID-19 notes series, is far from a platform of partisan alarm or hysteria. It is among the most sober and high-minded professional journals in the country. It's worth reading the correspondence written by an executive running a small health system at some length. And the executive writes, our supply chain group has worked around the clock to secure gowns, gloves, face masks, goggles, face shields, and N95 respirators. These employees have adapted to a new normal, exploring every lead, no matter how unusual. Deals, some bizarre and convoluted, and many involving large sums of money, have dissolved at the last minute when we were outbid or outmuscled, sometimes by the federal government. Then we got lucky, but getting the supplies was not easy. A lead came from an acquaintance of a friend of a team member. After several hours of vetting, we grew confident of the broker's professional pedigree and the potential to secure a large shipment of 3-ply face masks and N95 respirators. The latter were KN95 respirators, N95s that were made in China. We received samples to confirm that they could be successfully fit tested. Despite having cleared this hurdle, we remain concerned that the surplus samples might not be representative of the bulk of the products that we would be buying. Having acquired the requisite funds, more than 5 times the amount we would normally pay for a similar shipment, but still less than what was being requested by other brokers, we set the plan in motion. 3 members of the supply chain team and a fit tester were flown to a small airport near an industrial warehouse in the Mid-Atlantic region. I arrived by car to make the final call on whether to execute the deal. 2 semi-trailer trucks, cleverly marked as food service vehicles, met us at the warehouse. When fully loaded, the trucks would take 2 distinct routes back to Massachusetts to minimize the chances that their contents would be detained or redirected. They're trying to get medical gear here, folks. It's like a whodunit. Hours before our planned departure, we were told to expect only a quarter of our original order. We went anyway, since we desperately needed any supplies we could get. Upon arrival, we were jubilant to see pallets of KN95 respirators and face masks being unloaded. We opened several boxes, examined their contents, and hoped that this random sample would be representative of the entire shipment. Before we could send the funds by wire transfer, 2 Federal Bureau of Investigation agents arrived, showed their badges, and started questioning me. No, the shipment was not headed for resale or the black market. The agents checked my credentials, and I tried to convince them that the shipment of PPE was bound for hospitals. After receiving my assurances and hearing about our health system's urgent needs, the agents let the boxes of equipment be released and loaded into the trucks. But I was soon shocked to learn that the Department of Homeland Security was still considering redirecting our PPE. Only some quick calls leading to intervention by our congressional representative prevented its seizure. I remained nervous and worried on the long drive back, feelings that did not abate until midnight when I received the call that the PPE shipment was secured at our warehouse. Now, I don't know about you, but this just truly boggled my mind. I mean, I had heard that there's some weird stuff going on. I mean, in terms of seizing shipments, both in other countries and in this country. I knew that the federal government was not playing any coordinating role in either amping up the production of face masks. Apparently, they did finally get GE, I guess, to make respirators. And certainly not intervening in these bidding wars. In fact, they're entering into bidding wars themselves. I hope we all know that this is the result of the rabid, you know, so-called free market, which is a total misnomer, ideology that was set in motion by, you know, the Chicago School, Friedman, and Reaganomics really brought it in with a vengeance, obviously in Chile with Pinochet. We know that this has been sort of the ruling ideology of the world that now is sort of being challenged, ironically, mostly by this pandemic, although they're not going to go down easy. So anyway, Celeste, do we have any callers?
Not as yet, Paul.
Okay, 503-231-8187. I think it's really important, this article is important. David Wallace Wells, the White House has erected a blockade stopping states and hospitals from getting coronavirus PPE. So let me just to read this article. Whenever you start to think that the federal government under Donald Trump has hit a moral bottom, it finds a new way to shock and horrify. Over the last few weeks, it started to appear as though, in addition to abandoning the states to their own devices in a time of national emergency, the federal government has effectively erected a blockade like that which the Union used to choke off the supply chains of the Confederacy during the Civil War to prevent delivery of critical medical equipment to states desperately in need. At the very least, federal authorities have made governors and hospital executives all around the country operate in fear that shipments of necessary supplies will be seized along the way. In a time of pandemic, having evacuated federal responsibility, the White House is functionally waging a war against state leadership and the initiative of local hospitals to secure what they need to provide sufficient treatment. I'll just add a little parenthesis here. And of course, the governor of New York, Cuomo, had to fly to Washington, perhaps to prostrate himself at the feet maybe of Trump. Maybe that's what he's looking for. Yesterday, a letter published. Oh, I read this about what I just read. That was in the New England Journal of Medicine. So in this instance, the executive, who I was just reading from, managed to secure the supplies. But what is most horrifying about his account is that this experience was not all that surprising to him. He expected interference from federal officials and did everything he could, including staging the shipment in food service trucks to avoid detection, to get around that interference. Those measures do not seem unusual, horrifyingly enough. Last month, 3 million masks ordered by the state of Massachusetts were seized by the federal government. Last week, the Chicago Sun-Times reported that the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, was arranging secret chartered flights of supplies as a way of outmaneuvering federal interference. Quote, the governor has clearly outlined the challenges this administration has faced as we've worked around the clock to purchase PPE for our healthcare workers and first responders, a spokesperson for the governor told the paper. The supply chain has been likened to the Wild West, and once you have purchased supplies, ensuring they get to the state is another Herculean feat, he continued. These flights are carrying millions of masks and gloves our workers need. They're scheduled to land in Illinois in the coming weeks, and the state is working to ensure these much-needed supplies are protected and ready for distribution around the state. I mean, are they going to have to deploy the state militia? I mean, are we getting to the level of a civil war? I heard that Attorney General Barr was now considering actions to force governors of states to reopen for business on, their schedule. I mean, is that what's going on? I mean, is Juan Gonzalez's thoughts what's really happening? Are they leading up to some kind of coup in the basis, in the event that Biden actually miraculously wins the election? Is it just a continued ideological war against socialism? Is it an inability? Is it the idea that anything that smacks of the federal government actually intervening that is socialist and is anathema to the Koch brothers and the other deciders of the elites? I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that or anything else. 503-231-8187. If Celeste doesn't break in at any moment that she wants to let me know that someone has called in, I'm just going to keep reading a little bit this. I wanted to get some other things, but okay, so this is not just the federal government telling states they are on their own, as it has done repeatedly over the last few weeks. A sign that the president, often thought to harbor authoritarian impulses, will invariably choose to unburden himself of responsibility, even when seizing it would offer remarkable new powers, in itself a moral outrage demonstrating incredible political sadism, given that states lack the resources of the federal government to pay for this stuff, which made me wonder, you know, about the boldness of Massachusetts, being the first state to budget for contact tracing, which is clearly what the federal government should be leading the way on and is not. And again, is the only way to really emerge from this crisis with both maximum intactness of the economy and the health of the people of the United States. Okay, so that's in part the states lacking the resources, because in many cases states are legally barred from deficit spending. I was just looking into that this morning. That's a little bit more complicated. The basically mandating a balanced budget. Some of it's in the Constitution, some of it's statutory, some of it's based on judicial decisions. There's it's a little more complicated, but there is that fact. So let me just continue reading. States are legally barred from deficit spending, which means in times of crisis, especially those producing huge budget shortfalls through collapsing tax revenue, they are functionally unable to respond at all. So that's another thing we're facing, which I'm sure, unfortunately, the Trump administration is well aware of and is undoubtedly taking full both political and economic advantage of. Okay, I'm going to continue from David Wallace.
If you wait a moment, Paul, you do have a call. We have Joe online for you.
Okay. Hello, Joe.
Morning, Paul.
Good morning.
I wanted to kind of back up to the moment what you were saying just before about the Trump administration forcing governors, or not the administration, but the attorney general Barr trying to force governors to open up their states. And I think that we need to also be having that conversation at the level of, it's not just something that, you know, these politicians, these administrations are doing. There's going to be, like, opening up means allowing the flow of labor, of labor that quote unquote chooses to employ itself with business owners, because we live in a supposedly free country, and how at that level there's so much resentment, not just from the, like, spectacle of the people protesting the lockdown, but of people who maybe don't have, like, that pointed of a narrative about it, but who are nonetheless just very kind of upset that they do not have what they need. And that resentment is going to be tapped into, like, even if it isn't Trump calling for a particular kind of militia movement to support him, it's going to be there to spoil the well. Like, that even if we remove Trump, it is about, I think, making it impossible to achieve any kind of unity around what we really need.
Well, keep going. I guess I'm
wondering.
My ears are starting to click to get up to what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what what do we need to be asking as a community of mostly working class people to other mostly working class people about what does it mean to refuse labor in this time and the perilous position that puts some of us rather than others in as far as knowing where you're going to get the money that this scam society forces you to use to get what you need. And that we need to be pushing the conversation down to the level of the masses, because we talk about like what's happening in terms of these power players that sit at the top of a Ponzi scheme, when in reality the people who are moving things or not moving things and everything is coming to a crash because of that are the millions of us who are talking and listening like we are now.
I feel in an awkward position because I feel somewhat removed from that, and I'm not really having those kind of conversations with people. So this is important for me to hear, and I certainly do follow, you know, what's going on with, you know, people like say Amazon. I mean, just what are they risking? What are they risking first? Amazon being like the biggest employer now, which is one of among the millions of contradictions that this situation is both revealing and forcing and exacerbating, them going to work in dangerous situations, and then what do they risk by refusing to go to work in a dangerous situation? What does any worker risk in, you know, because, and especially because jobs are such an incredible premium. This is like the worst nightmare of capitalist, you know, scarcity.
Well, I mean, I think that to kind of go back to what you were talking about, the dying neoliberal strategy, that this is potentially unfolding like one last death throw of it, because what it relies on is the immense, massive, but very kind of diffuse pressure of everybody having to work for a living. And there are a lot of people out there who don't have anything to live on now and who are going to be in the position to say, I don't care. I'm going to take care of me and my own, because Lord knows no one else has. And that is a real problem, because it's the same kind of question that workers who have been trying to organize have faced in terms of scabbing, in terms of stopping the operation of the machine and there being those people who want to keep it going. And that we need to be having conversations amongst each other about how we share the burden and the power and the risk, so that people feel like they can join up with a mass movement again. Because I think that the isolation right now that we're experiencing is totally incidental to the pandemic and to the proper response to it, but it also only worsens our weak sense of solidarity and of class consciousness. And really, it's going to take a mass movement to oust this regime, not just Trump, but the whole rotten thing. And we know that if we don't pull out the whole rotten thing, it's going to metastasize and be irremovable.
True words. I hope it resonates with some other people as well, and they want to call in. We have about a half an hour left, 503-231-8187. Any final thoughts before we give other people a shot?
No, thanks for giving me the mic.
Okay, I appreciate that, Joe. And it's the contradictions that this is, as I said, both revealing and exacerbating and forcing are numerous. One of which I'll just throw out there. I think that's perhaps the most crucial tangent or thing to focus on is what Joe is saying, because that's where we need to, you know, the rent strikes that are going on, the various, you know, the labor organizing in the face of this, the protests that healthcare workers are doing, you know, in very difficult circumstances. To me, that's kind of like the, you know, really the center of the response to what's going on. That's where we have a chance to combat these, what I think are truly misguided, open up or so-called liberate the appropriation of language is just breathtaking. Protests, which, as I said, are not focused on reality, which is that what we need to do is do widespread testing, isolating infected people as best possible, contact tracing of those that they have been in contact with, and then quarantining those people and isolating the people who end up getting infected. It's exactly the kind of thing that, you know, these rabid neoliberal so-called free marketers who, you know, when it comes to starting wars are anything but free marketers, as we know. But that's what they're it's anathema to them, the idea of responding in a coordinated way, which is the only way, as I've been pointing out, to actually, bring us back to, you know, we don't want normalcy, as Joe said, but we do want people to be able to make a living and to, you know, to be able to stay alive. So as we wait for somebody else to call at 503-231-8187.
And you have another caller. We have Sean on the line, but before I put him on, you did get a kudos call from Karen and Matt from Vancouver.
Well, thank you, Karen and Matt.
And we have Sean here for you now.
Okay, Sean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Paul. Paul, recently I watched a podcast called Useful Idiots from Rolling Stone magazine with Katie Halper and Matt Taibbi. They interviewed someone named Matt Stoller, who's written a book called Gargantuan, basically about the whole neoliberal monster, I guess. But he was saying the failure of people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders in the Senate, or the Squad in the House, to stand up to the massive trillion-dollar bailout, that represented like a complete and total, like, final collapse of whatever we have calling itself like an institutional left in this country. So like that kind of fills me with like a sense of dread and almost panic, really. It's hard to like not fall into a mentality of like, you know, how do we become like survivalists or preppers, or, you know what I mean? Because it seems like the entire Bernie phenomenon, when Paul Street was interviewed by Chris Hedges, Paul Street from Counterpunch, Paul Street basically said Bernie was a faker, you know, like the whole thing is a big fake out, you know, like he's just sheepdogging, he's trying to bring people into the institutional, you know, Democratic Party, the corporate Democrats and all that. So I don't know about you, but you know, that sort of means that the last like 30 years or whatever of my life have been pretty much squandered, and it's hard not to feel like a sense of total panic and total betrayal, and it just feels like we're a broken people. We're you know, set adrift. We have no class consciousness, no solidarity. Everything is in a state of complete collapse. Derek Jensen, of course, famously said.
Hold on, Sean. Let's talk for a second about whatever these bills are called that are trying to address, which obviously are not just inadequate, but basically just perpetuate and give away more money that, you know, this pittance that people are going to get, these so-called relief checks, are going to have to be paid back and with interest because of all the money being given away. But so these people, you know, that you're the people in the Senate of the Congress, you got to admit, for, you know, they are in a difficult position because they're drastically outnumbered, and in terms of both within the Democratic Party and in general, and they're obviously feeling forced to just pass something that has something.
But
you know,
Paul, the whole reason they were put there was to be leaders. You're one moment of leverage, and you don't emit so much as a squeak. It's as if history had culminated in the moment for these leftists to finally seize the opportunity for maximum leverage, and all they did is reveal themselves as complete backstabbing traitors to the people.
Well, it'd be interesting
to
hear other people's
perspective. To Wall Street and the multi-billionaire class.
Well, at this, I would like to. This gives me a chance to say that next week I'm going to actually have Norman Solomon on, so we're actually going to have a lively conversation. He's been a real backer of Sanders. In fact, I believe he was a delegate to the convention for Sanders last time around 4 years ago, and he's been writing some stuff, which I'm definitely going to prepare a program page for that show. So,
Paul, don't you think, like, in response to the whole Ralph Nader thing in the year 2000, this whole thing has been a scheme cooked up by the Democratic Party to eliminate third-party challengers, that they put out, quote-unquote, the Bernie phenomenon as a way of taking all the energy away from, like, an anti-capitalist, you know, third-party movement, and then just, like, you know, just completely, you know, sheepdogging us into the whole neoliberal capitalist
project. That could be. I'm not sure I see that. I'm sure other people have a lot of different opinions, but that's a powerful perspective that I respect. Any final thoughts before we let other people take the mic?
Oh, no, thank you, Paul. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk. Like I said, I'm filled with just a sense of complete panic and despair, and it feels good to not bottle it all up and at least talk about it with
somebody.
So thank you.
Well, that's one thing that talk radio is for, amongst others. 503-231-8187. I said Norman Solomon is going to be on, a former Portlander who's a founder of Root Action, been heavily involved in the fairness, accuracy, and reporting over the years. I mean, he may have even been one of the founders of that. He has a very his own perspective on the whole denouement, the ending of the Sanders campaign, and the whole issue of whether to support or how much to support Joe Biden. We'll be talking about all that next week here on Wednesday Talk Radio. Right now, I'm looking to hear your perspectives on both the very, very disturbing scenario that is playing itself out in the both the lack of a real federal response to this pandemic and what their actual agenda is, which I'm putting out my view. And again, as Joe pointed out earlier, these things are happening at these big levels, but we here down on the ground floor, which community radio strives its best to both reflect and bolster, we are having to both come to terms with, understand what's going on, and formulate some kind of response. In this case, a political response, which is hopefully parallel to and in conjunction with the mutual aid direct response that many people are doing here in Portland, helping deliver food to people who can't go out and get it, medical supplies, sewing masks. I mean, why are we having to sew masks? These are questions that obviously don't really have an answer, and the answer is one that we may not want to confront.
Well, okay, so would you like to confront and converse with your next caller?
I certainly would, Celeste.
Okay, we have Robbie here online. Good morning, Robbie. You're on the air.
Hello, go ahead.
Good morning, Robbie. You're on the air. Okay, well, we're having a little technical difficulties, so while I get him back, go right ahead.
Okay, well, let me just jump to this, since it is Earth Day, and I did want to mention briefly, I'll just repeat, before I talk a little bit about KBOO Radio being in our virtual membership drive, as it were, since the station is shut down to volunteers for health and safety reasons, and so we're not going to have our regular April membership drive, but I want to just mention again Michael Moore's Planet of the Humans, which is just released yesterday, free of charge on YouTube. This is a Reuters article. As environmentalists celebrate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day this week, a new documentary poses a sobering question. What if wind farms, solar panels, and other green energy projects are not enough to save the planet, and humanity simply cannot sustain life as we know it? Planet of the Humans, executive produced by Oscar-winning filmmaker Michael Moore and written and directed by Jeff Gibbs, asks hard questions about what it sees as a failure of well-meaning
is
effort.
Is this Robbie?
What's it?
Okay.
We have Robbie back?
All right, a different Paul. And let me put you on hold. I've been having a little bit of issues with the phone, so bear with us.
Okay.
Okay.
So let me just continue, I guess, for a second. It seems like we've been losing the battle, Moore told Reuters. We're in deep, deep trouble. So, to add not even a lighter note to the and I'm laughing because, you know, laugh to keep from crying. The, you know, we're in a twin dilemma here with the pandemic and then the looming issue of climate change. And we should, if we had somebody who wasn't clinging to the last vestiges of ruthless fossil fuel-based neoliberal capitalism in charge here, we would be, this would be actually a moment, this pandemic, as I was saying earlier, to look at a real transition. It gives us actually a terrible but a unique opportunity to move away from fossil fuels while fossil fuel use is dramatically reduced. The skies are clearing up, and until the deregulations that Trump is passing, the further deregulations of letting industry continue to pollute, the perhaps the waters are even clearing up. People can see the Himalayas in India from like 150 miles away or something for the first time in 30 years.
And, Paul, we have another caller here. Apologies to Robbie, but we have another Paul on the air for you here. So let's pot him up. Paul, are you with us?
Yes, sir.
All right, good.
So howdy, Paul. I want to agree pretty much with Sean, except I don't find it panic-driven or anything like that. What I would like to see is that we now get serious about the third party, the Socialist Party, the Class Conscious Party, whatever you want to call it. And so I've got a question, and that is, I don't listen to everything on cable because I'm busy during the day and one thing or another, but I don't hear anything that I would call, it's analytical shows, and I don't hear anything that is sort of driving toward that class-conscious solution of a workers' party. So my question is, am I correct? And if so, is there something about KBOO's structure? Has DSA contacted? Has Green Party contacted? Has anybody contacted KBOO and tried to set up a segment for actually trying to organize a party?
That's an answer that's beyond my ability to respond. As a volunteer, I'm not privy to whatever communications are had with our programming people. So I can't. That's a specific question. I have no way of answering at all. Whether or not other people have been focusing on it, I, like you, don't listen to KBOO 24/7, so I can't fully answer that either. My kind of quick and maybe too easy responses, I think a lot of the energy was directed to the Sanders campaign. So, you know, if Sean is right, and I can't say as my intuitive or whatever informed understanding, to the extent that it is informed, would not agree that it was just completely a setup by the whatever the corporate Democrats, but you know, maybe so. So my interpretation is that so much energy was going, you know, including from DSA was supporting Sanders. So, you know, there you have that. I mean, as far as the Greens, that's a conversation that I'm not sure I feel equipped to. I know that, you know, a lot of people are now supporting Howie Hawkins, who's the presidential candidate. I don't think we've had Howie Hawkins on the air. I think he's been on Dennis Bernstein's. I know Howie's been interviewed by Dennis Bernstein on Flashpoints. So that's one place where there is some conversation. I know Dennis does talk about that. I don't think he's been on Democracy Now. I haven't reached out to him. I don't think other people. As far as local green organizing, no, there isn't a whole lot of conversation. Again, I think a lot of the energy, a lot of the, was just directed towards the Sanders campaign, and a lot of people are feeling, you know, who put a lot of stock in that are feeling very deflated, and it's, you know, it's just another thing to add to the sort of a lot of the feelings of disempowerment that are going on.
Well, I agree with you, and I think the point I'd like to promote is that KBOO's in a great position to do something along the line of trying to organize that and just analyze. And so I'll just make a point of calling programs and see what's going on, and I'll talk to DSA and see whether there's something we could get together on.
Sounds good, Paul. I appreciate that. Good to hear from you. I suspect that as far as KBOO taking an organizing role, I could be wrong, but I do believe there are some restrictions on our ability to, you know, to particularly favor a particular candidate or party. Certainly we can promote conversations around all this stuff, so it's good to hear that perspective. We've got about 10 minutes left. As I said, I did want to mention that, as you probably heard, we have announcements running that our regular membership drive has been canceled for this spring, which, as you know, we are a listener-sponsored station. We are heirs to the model of a KPFA in Berkeley, which started this whole thing off, including National Public Radio. It preceded National Public Radio. We are an affiliate of the Pacifica Network. That's why we run Democracy Now! And Flashpoints and other programming from Pacifica. And we are the oldest independent listener-sponsored station in the country. And it's a model that has functioned. And so we depend on, usually, on these membership, we depend on these membership drives. The fact that we're not going to be able to have one because of COVID is obviously something we have to deal with as a station. So we look to you, listeners, new listeners, regular listeners, anybody listening to my voice right now, we look to you to the best of your ability to support us. KBOO.fm/give. That's where you can go. There is no phone number this time around. We recognize a lot of people are struggling economically. If you yourself are not struggling right now and recognize the vital service that KBOO offers to the community as a community radio station, please do consider contributing. KBOO.fm/give. Okay. 503-231-8187. We've got less than 10 minutes left. A lot of people wait till the last minute. Perhaps that's you. We've got any more callers, Celeste? Looks like we don't. So I'm going to, as I said, there's this movie that, you know, a lot of people are shying away from the heaviness, the added heaviness of looking at what's going on. And that's totally understandable. A lot of people are struggling in a lot of different ways.
And we have another caller for you, Paul.
Okay.
We have Brian for you.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Brian.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yep, okay, good. Hey, I was just talking. I'm not talking. I was thinking about some of the things that you were talking about earlier about, you know, the possibility that Trump administration kind of forces the issue as far as pushing states to open up before they otherwise wouldn't, you know, open up before the health authorities recommend. And I'm just wondering if this is going to be, you know, people like me and other people I know that seem to be rational want to be as safe as possible, so we want to hold out as long as possible to avoid reigniting this thing any worse than it probably will anyway. But is that going to push people into a situation where supposedly everything's opened up and markets are still are working again supposedly, but some people are willing to gamble more and it's worth it to them to jump in, and they will take advantage of that, you know, like that benefit as far as, you know, making a living, they'll take advantage of it. They're willing to take the chance, while other people will hold back and not willing to take the chance, and it'll create disparity and hard feelings within communities because some people are willing to jump back in. For example, me, I'm a private music instructor, and I haven't been teaching directly, but will there possibly be some members of the community that might think that I'm foolish for remaining, you know, in place while they're willing to step out? Does that make sense?
No, I think Joe was pointing out something very similar earlier, and there's the fact that there's people who for health reasons, you know, maybe they're immune compromised, maybe they have diabetes, maybe they have some other condition, and of course, as we know, these conditions, for economic reasons, do tend to affect people of color, poor communities more than others. So it will, yeah, I think it will add just to the inequity, it will multiply inequities. I think you're right.
Yeah, it's like everything that this administration does that. It just magnifies already existing things to a ridiculous degree.
Yeah, you're right. And the shocking thing to think, one never wants to actually think that, you know, I think people, well-meaning people, don't want to think that these are actually possibly strategic moves being done, similar to Pinochet coming to power and killing all his adversaries.
Yeah, you just don't want to believe that somebody could be that vile, but I guess it can happen. thank you for the discussion. I just wanted to hear more about, you know, my question, or I wanted to hear other people possibly talk about this and see what we can do, but I guess there's not much we can do.
I think organizing in the face of it and having hard conversations with, you know, the problem with these liberate protests is no one wants to go up and have an actual, you know, I would, you know, I went and had conversations with the Patriot Prayer people when they had their,
wow,
you know, last couple of years had their protest, because I wanted to know what the heck they really thought. And
I did too.
Yeah. So, but we don't want to go to these liberate protests.
Rational people can think this way, but I guess if you had a chance to be one-on-one, you might get a clue.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and I was just saying that's the problem with these liberate protests is there's so many people packed together, and it's already been demonstrated that the one of those protests in Kentucky resulted in a spike. I think all those protests
are going
to result in spikes.
Is there somewhere I could go to read on that? Do you remember your source for that?
Google Kentucky spike COVID, you know, I use your imagination, but I'm pretty sure,
okay,
I saw an article specifically addressing that. Yeah,
I just knew that must happen. That I know that has to be happening or have happened, but I'd like to read about it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Kabu's worked it out so we can actually talk to you.
Yeah. No, Kabu, I admire how we've been. I think the music shows are sounding really, really, really good and better and better. I think I myself haven't figured out. I host one of those early morning folk shows. I'm embarrassed to admit I'm still working on figuring out how to do it myself. But all the other music hosts seem to have figured out, and we definitely are able to do our talk shows, which is nice.
Wanted to touch base on the Miles Davis conversation. I had already called the station and thanked them for playing Miles in the breaks.
Right. Okay, well, we got to go. I think we might have another caller, maybe not. Miles Davis, right on. What a towering figure. What a great documentary. Birth of the Cool, I believe that was the name of it. Any last caller?
Well, let's see. You've only got about a minute, so do you want to try? We might have one more caller. I'll check, and you've got 3 minutes.
Okay.
Excuse me, 2 minutes.
Well, I wanted to mention another article from DSmog website. COVID-19 liberate groups are the same ones pushing climate denial. I didn't really get a chance to go any further with the new Michael Moore produced documentary Planet of the Humans, which you can find on YouTube now for free. But on the linking together of the COVID and the climate, this is a really valuable article.
I have one more caller. We can try to get him on really quickly for you, Paul. This is Thomas.
Okay, go ahead, Thomas.
Yeah. Hi, Paul. You know, I heard the callers call, you know, saying how frustrated they are with the way things are, feeling dejected and demoralized and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I can certainly understand that because I kind of go there myself. And the way, but the way I see this right now is that there's, in my mind, I've got a couple of choices. And one of the choices is doing it through the political system. As you've been talking about, you know, a new Green Party and all of that, organizing within the political system, I mean, that's going to go so far. My encouragement for that is Ralph Nader. He's really in there thinking that we can go and lobby Congress and get things done if it's done the right way. Okay, but beyond that, and this has been done in a lot of countries, very effectively so, to, you know, a mass rising, a mass, you know, movement of the people. And there's this little book, a little red book, called From Dictatorship to Democracy by Gene Sharp. And he has, this is unbelievable, but he has 198 ways to do that in this little book. This book has been banned in authoritarian countries because of its effectiveness. And I thought he said in the book that it was used in the Arab Spring, of that uprising. But it has been used, and these tactics have been done, in real dictatorships. I mean, when this goes over to military authoritarian control, people have risen up using these techniques, strategizing, using good and different tactics to
That's got to be the last word. From Dictatorship to Democracy by Gene Sharp, as one tool in the toolbox.
Okay, and thank you for that, Thomas, because we got to go.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thanks, West.
You're very welcome. And it is 8:59 here on KBOO Portland. You got about 30 seconds. Well, I guess that was it. We want to thank you, everyone, for your participation, for listening, and for those of you who are able, for financially supporting your community connection, KBOO Portland.
But thanks to an anonymous donor, every dollar contributed